Jacques Duval once said, "God loved the birds and invented trees. Man loved the birds and invented cages." Welcome to episode 20 of Our Hen House, a place to find our way to change the world for animals. In today's episode, we will update you on a very special adoption event where we were overwhelmed with cuteness. We'll then let you in on a pretty silly mistake that I made on last week's show, though you probably already noticed yourself. Joining us today is Brad Goldberg, founder of Animal Welfare Trust and Animal Welfare Advocacy. Brad will talk about the importance of philanthropic grants that benefit animal issues. Then, we'll be joined for a brief update by Kelly Overton from PATH. As the oil hits the Gulf, Kelly, who joins us from New Orleans this week, will let us know how the rescue efforts are coming along. In our news section, we will go over some sad news for animals, which, thankfully, is at least getting some very mainstream attention. That is MFA's undercover investigation and a puppy mill report brought to us, shockingly, by the USDA itself. Finally, we'll discuss the results of a survey we conducted asking people what they think is the biggest misconception about veganism and how they like to respond when those misconceptions arise for them.
I'll tell you how I respond.
My name is Jasmine Singer, and I'll be your co-host today in our hen house, along with my best girl, Marianne Sullivan. We are delighted that you've decided to join us today in our hen house, where we've just heard that our little rescue dog in Puerto Rico, Tips, has several possible adoptive homes. Now please, pull up some hay, let's get squawking. I'd like to welcome my co-host, Marianne Sullivan.
Hello, my little poodle.
Poodle. I'm always little. Why am I always my little, your little something?
Well, do you want me to change it to big?
No.
Well, I just noticed. Be happy with little.
Last week we went to the Adopt-a-Palooza in Washington Square Park.
I just thought of it. Should have been the Adopt-a-Poodalooza.
Adopt-a-Poodalooza.
Well, if it had been all poodles.
No, it should have been Adopt-a-Pitbullooza.
Yeah, they were the pit bulls were the cutest.
Or Adopt-a-Pitbullwinna.
I agree.
So it was an event that the Mayor's Alliance had, and it's where lots of amazing dogs and cats were up for adoption. I filmed it.
They were so cute.
They were unbelievable. You want to know something funny? This is kind of weird. I shouldn't admit this, but since it's only you and me here, right? I'll admit it. Sometimes after doing that video and being there right before I'm going to sleep, like I'll close my eyes and all I can see is cute dogs.
Yeah, well, you have that whole weird thing where when you close your eyes at night, you see things.
But I
don't even understand what that is, and I don't think we should talk about it in public because it makes you sound like you're insane.
No, I think it makes you sound insane. And when you close your eyes, can't you visualize things? No, you can't because you're weird. I can, and you can't.
That's what makes us different.
That's their difference. You heard it here first in our hen house. So what else? Last week, I made a fool of myself on our podcast, and it's staying there forever.
I don't think it's quite that strong. It was just a little mispronunciation.
I said St. Francis of Assisi instead of St. Francis of Assisi.
Well, you're not Catholic. Why should you know his name?
Because
I'm sure he wouldn't mind. He was a very nice person.
Did you know him?
No. I know him.
How
old,
do you know
but
he
I'm
was
not
a nice
quite
person.
That old? Well, the reputation is he liked animals.
I mean,
in the Catholic Church, that's not hard to get away with. I mean, that is hard to get away with, liking animals.
I'm a Schlemiel.
Schlemazel.
Schlemiel.
Hoss and Pepper Incorporated.
So, are you as obsessed with Glee as I am?
Well, you know I am, honey. You know I am.
We watch it on Hulu because it shows up on Hulu.com the day after it is on the real television.
I'm sure there are people who don't like Glee, but I just find that inexplicable.
I do, too. Someone on Facebook once said that they didn't get it, and I said, people sing it, it's ironic. I mean, what else
is
there to
get? Yeah, what more do you want in life?
And so now what's going through my head is Lady Gaga songs because this past week it was like a Lady Gaga episode.
Yeah.
But I don't know how she does it, so I make up my own words to the melody. It'll be like, I have to walk the dog around Thompson Street.
That's very clever, honey. I think Lady Gaga should stick with her own particular lyrics.
You don't think I have a future as a lyricist for Lady Gaga?
Maybe not.
I wonder how she came up with Lady Gaga, like the name.
I want us to do a Glee podcast.
I think that would be amazing. I think that I've dreamt about that for like 30 years, quite literally.
Oh, dear. Do you think we'd lose all our listeners?
I think that we would potentially, but you know what? It would be worth it because it would be fun. So, what else is going on?
Well, it's just been a depressing week. I mean, so many bad things have really happened, but as we'll be talking about later, some of the news that's been coming out this week has just been so horrifying that it was nice to go to the Adopt-a-Palooza and have one animal happy day and see a bunch of dogs and cats finding nice places to live, and it just made me feel a little better about the world.
Dogs and cats got adopted.
Ay vey.
I know, I agree though. I mean, all kidding aside, I'm kind of wanting to kill myself. Well, not really.
And you made a video.
I made a video. I take that back. I don't really want to kill myself because if I wanted to kill myself, there would be like less than one. There would be one fewer person fighting for these animals. Actually, you said I made a video. Do you remember when I lost all of the footage and the file was corrupt?
Yeah, I am trying to block out the memories of that night, but I can't.
Yeah, it was like a technical disaster. I was a mess. I went to the Mac store the next day and I spent like 6 hours there. And they finally recovered my files. But it just like kind of reinforces the point that we're way too reliant on tech stuff.
Yeah, and you did have everything backed up, but then you couldn't access it from the computer, backup file.
Right. It was messy, but whatever. I mean, you live, you learn, and you buy a hard drive, and you back up. I'm excited that we have Brad Goldberg on our show today.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk to him. Let's get started.
Okay. Brad Goldberg spent 35 years in the investment management business as senior vice president for Jennison Associates, a subsidiary of Prudential Financial. He has had a long-term interest in conservation and animal protection issues. In 2001, Brad organized Animal Welfare Trust as a private operating foundation dedicated to animal welfare issues. And in 2003, started Animal Welfare Advocacy as a sister organization to AWT to promote legislative initiatives. Brad serves as chair of HEART, that's Humane Education Advocates Reaching Teachers, and is a trustee of the Wildlife Conservation Society and the Cultural Institutions Retirement System. Brad received his undergraduate degree from the University of Illinois and an MBA from New York University and is a chartered financial analyst. Welcome to our hen house, Brad.
It's a pleasure to be part of your Our Hen House podcast. Thank you.
Well, we're excited to have you. Brad, can you tell us how you went from a career on Wall Street to a career helping animals?
Well, that would be a long-winded answer, but I think I can just sum it up by saying that I have always wanted to get involved with animal rights issues. Since the earliest days of my childhood, I remember, you know, having an affinity for animals and a concern over their welfare, and certainly have carried that into my adult life. And when I got to a stage of my career where I thought I had basically fulfilled my professional ambitions, it was just a natural progression to turn my attention to animal rights. And I established Animal Welfare Trust in 2001 to basically be the main vehicle in order to carry out that action.
Well, that's really cool. I just love that story. Can you tell us how the Animal Welfare Trust works? I'm sure many of our listeners would be very interested.
Well, Animal Welfare Trust is a private foundation that obviously funds in animal welfare, animal rights related projects. I think that it's important to point out something that is my pet peeve in the philanthropic arena, and that is that there is really very little foundation funding that takes place in the direction of animal rights. Mm-hmm. The Foundation Center tracks a distribution of grants by categories, and the last statistics that I saw was that about 6.8% of foundation grants went to their broad category of environment and animals. But only 1.2% went for the animal component, with by far the largest going to the environment. Even that wouldn't be too bad on the surface, since that's 1.2% of a very large number, something like $22 billion. But the fact is that the vast part of that 1.2% is represented by grants to conservation and zoos, and the money that finds its way to animal welfare and animal rights is really minuscule. So we really need to encourage foundations to consider the void of funding in this area and get involved. And Animal Welfare Trust is a small organization, but we're just trying to do our small part.
That's such an important point. I think so many people are unaware of how little philanthropic money goes to animal causes. They're really deceived about it.
I think it is really not on the radar screen of most foundations, even those foundations that fund in animal-related areas, which tends to go to conservation and, you know, a lot of areas that are outside of animal rights per se. And that's not to say that there's not a great need in those other areas. But the amount of funding that actually makes its way to animal rights kinds of organizations and projects is really quite low.
So when somebody does apply to a grant to Animal Welfare Trust, which is devoted to this particular subject, what do you look for in a grant application to engage your interest?
Well, we like to give to organizations where we think we can get the biggest bang for our buck, so to speak. And we have limited funds, so what we try to do, for the most part, not exclusively, but for the most part, is give out to projects that we think where our funding can really make an impact. And this often takes us into making grants to smaller organizations where the risk of the grant maybe not going quite as planned, maybe larger, but the potential payoff could be all that more meaningful. And we particularly like to fund projects where our funding is critical to the project being able to move forward. You know, the other aspect of Animal Welfare Trust that I want to mention is that we are different from many private foundations in that we are an operating foundation. And that means is that in addition to giving grants to other organizations, as private foundations do, we also get involved in direct project grants, which I'm sure we'll discuss as this podcast moves forward. And in addition to that, we have a student internship grant program where we give grants directly to students, graduate level students, for independent research projects, usually over the summer. So we're not, the bulk of our grant making is giving grants in a traditional sense to other organizations, but we also have that direct grant program and the student internship grant program, which is somewhat different from what many foundations can do, in that they are not classified as an operating foundation.
Yes, we definitely want to talk about both the student project and your other projects. But before we move on to that, can you just give an idea of what the average size of your grants are and what particular subject areas within animal welfare you're interested in?
The main grant program, the average size of the grants average over the last 5 years, let's say, has been about $8,500 per grant. And the range on that has been as low as $2,500 and as high as $20,000. But in general, it has come out to about $8,500 per grant. The main areas that we fund, three main areas, farm animal welfare, vegetarianism, and humane education.
Those are three very important areas, that's for sure. And can you tell us a little bit more about the student grant program that you alluded to earlier?
Well, the student grant program is basically, as I mentioned, is geared largely for independent summer projects, although it doesn't necessarily have to be over the summer. And it's a way to get students who have interesting animal rights related projects, not only to reward them for being able to carry out their project, but really to encourage them to get involved in the animal rights movement moving forward. I mean, that's really one of the main objectives of the student grant program.
I think that's such a great program, because so many students who want to work in this area really aren't getting encouragement from their educational institutions, and seeing that this funding exists and encouraging them to do this kind of project or research will help bring this subject into the schools, into the colleges and universities.
Exactly.
So what have been some of your most satisfying accomplishments vis-a-vis your grant program that you've been able to, you feel, as you said, you wanted to be a funder of projects that probably wouldn't be able to go forward without you. Have you felt that that's happened, and what have been some of the most satisfying instances of that?
Well, I think that, you know, as I said, it's a high-risk, high-reward strategy, and we have had our share of disappointing grants, and we have had our share of grants that I think have helped projects really move forward, and in some cases, organizations move forward. But I think that the larger picture of where I think we have been successful is just helping, for example, in the farm animal arena. You know, I think that there has been a lot of progress over the last 10 years since we have started this grant program. Mm-hmm. Well, both in terms of vegetarianism as well as the recognition of the plight of farm animals in general. And I don't for a minute claim that Animal Welfare Trust, you know, had any major influence on the progress in either of those areas. But I do believe that collectively, organizations like Animal Welfare Trust and the many other grassroots organizations that are out there, you know, have resulted in some major progress and some major momentum moving forward being realized. So I just think that it's so important that, you know, it's these are such big issues that I don't think there's any one organization or any one group that can do it all. But I think that all the efforts combined are really beginning to make a difference. And so I'm just in a general sense, I think that without naming specific organizations, I think that in general, the major themes that we're addressing are going in the right direction. And I'm very pleased about that.
It does take a village, that's for sure. Change isn't going to happen just one person at a time, but the more community, well, I guess sometimes it does, but the more communities can come together and support efforts to end animal cruelty, the more accomplishments we're going to have in a quicker time frame. Brad, in addition to its grant program, Animal Welfare Trust has developed and spun off two vibrant organizations, HEART and the Coalition for Healthy School Food. How did that come about?
Well, let's take HEART first. Humane education is a priority funding area, has been since our inception, for several reasons. First is the belief that the most egregious conditions that compromise the welfare of animals and other humans in the environment, for that matter, are deep-rooted cultural practices that are passed along from generation to generation. And the best opportunity for interrupting that cycle is to give youth the opportunity to understand the issues and make up their own minds as to how they want to live their lives. I strongly believe that children have a natural love and interest in animals, and if given the opportunity, they will naturally take the high road with respect not only to animal issues, but social justice and environmental protection as well. But they have to be exposed to the issues and given that opportunity to act on their personal beliefs. And humane education can provide that that tool. Basically, we got involved with HART as a project of AWT because we were interested in funding humane education, but couldn't find organizations who were conducting direct humane education services to youth. So we decided we had no choice but to develop that capability ourselves. And beginning in 2005, under the leadership of Mina Alagappan, the executive director of HART, we have developed what we call our Humane Living Program, which is an age-appropriate instructional and service learning curriculum for grades K through 12. HART includes social justice and environmental ethics, along with animal welfare, as areas of focus. And we want youth to understand that all of these areas are interconnected, and to live a humane life really entails having compassion and respect for all living beings, including the environment. Over the past year, HART has reached over 4,000 students, and we significantly expanded the experiential learning part of our program, as well as expanded to Chicago. So that's the reason we got involved with HART, and that remains a very important direct services project for the organization. As far as the New York Coalition for Healthy School Food, AWT was one of the founding supporting organizations for the coalition, which goes back some 7 years. And one of the first things that was done before we even formed the nonprofit was we hired Amy Hamlin, who has been and still is the executive director of the coalition, who was able to get a resolution passed unanimously by the New York State Legislature, I believe it was in 2004, which called for plant-based option entrees in the school meal program, along with nutritional education and promoting farm-to-school programs. A key program of the coalition has been a pilot project at Future Leaders Institute Charter School in Harlem, where for the last 3 years, the coalition has introduced plant-based entrees on certain days of the week and introduced nutritional education, including a very successful family dinner night, which is held on a monthly basis. And that project, which was in partnership with New York City's Department of School Food and Candle 79, has now evolved into a very exciting, broader project, school food project, which has started serving plant-based meals in the cafeteria of 6 schools on selected days using recipes developed especially for the program, and hopefully this will be rolled out to a much larger group of schools in the fall. Now, the coalition approaches its mission from a children's health and nutritional platform. Clearly, there are multiple benefits of a vegetarian diet, and good health and well-being, along with concern for climate change and biodiversity, are powerful additional reasons in addition to animal welfare, which obviously is Animal Welfare Trust's focus in our farm animal work.
I think both of these projects are so exciting, and they both focus on young people, and I love the way you articulate how our purpose with young people is not to persuade them, really. It's just to tell them what's going on, give them the options, and they'll make the right choices, by and large.
Well, we strongly believe that to be the case. You're absolutely right.
So moving on to a topic about us, which is what we really like to talk about, we're headed off to Kansas City shortly. And I know it's been a while, Brad, since you were in Kansas City, but you did grow up there. So got any tips for us?
Well, you know, my memories of Kansas City as a child are not, you know, you started out by asking me how I got involved. And I remember, you know, Kansas City is obviously a major farming and historically meat production center. And I remember as a kid growing up in Kansas City, it was very common to see animals being hauled down the road on their way to slaughter. There were major slaughter facilities in Kansas City. And I'm sure that, those scenes, and as I remember them today, have a great deal to say about my current passion for farm animals. No question it had its roots back to those days. So when I think of Kansas City, which is a lovely city, and this time of year is the best time to visit it, but nevertheless, I think back to a city much like many cities in the U.S. that, from my perspective, had some real animal welfare issues, and I'm sure still do today. Although things have changed, and I'll be very anxious to hear how you guys find the city just in terms of being vegetarian friendly. And I know that there is a pretty vibrant community of animal activists there. I have lost track of them, and I'm not in touch with them directly, but I'll be interested also to see what your experience is with regard to that community.
Well, when I was at Farm Sanctuary, I was the National Walk for Farm Animals coordinator. We had a Kansas City walk, and it was one of our top 10. They have a great community there, that's for sure. And there's vegan restaurants popping up. I'm actually talking about Kansas City, Kansas. I don't
it's
know if
right
you're.
There.
I know,
right
it's next to they touch, but Kansas City, Missouri, they have a long way to go. No, I'm kidding.
Well, Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri are really one of the same. It's just a matter of crossing the border.
Right,
but the central part of Kansas City is in Missouri, and you know, I mean, that's really the beautiful part of the city.
Ha!
You'll see.
Well, thank you so much, Brad. You're such a... I've referred to you as this before, but I think it describes you perfectly. You're such an unsung hero in our movement, and we wanted to sing you a little bit.
So. Yeah, even though Brad wouldn't tell us what organizations were some of his favorite grants, which I can understand. You can't favor one of your children. I'll tell you, there's a lot of organizations out there that wouldn't exist without his seed money.
And we just love following your work. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the work that you guys are doing.
Oh, well, thanks, Brad. We appreciate that. And we will talk to you soon, I'm sure.
Great.
Gotta love Brad Goldberg and everything he is doing to create change. We are next going to be joined once again by Kelly Overton from People Protecting Animals and Their Habitats, who is going to give us a very brief update of how things are going down in the Gulf where he is currently stationed. Welcome back to our hen house, Kelly.
Hello, glad to be here, glad to be back.
And how are you and where are you to start off?
I'm well. I am in New Orleans today. It's one of my favorite places in the world.
Yeah, me too. It's such a great city, and God, it just seems so put upon.
Things are rough here again. You know, I've been using the term corporate Katrina this week, that Louisiana and New Orleans are really going to get hit because of the oil spill. You know, I'm starting to see some desperation. I'm also starting to see, you know, people pitching in to help each other. You know, I'm seeing a lot of little posters or, you know, end-up things about meetings, community meetings or protests or such. So, it's Louisiana's had a tough go the last 5 or 10 years.
And this is really the week that it hit, right? Or at least it started to.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. I mean, I just 5 minutes ago was reading in the Times-Picayune New Orleans paper of, I think, 9 different oil locations now. You know, it's, again, slow kind of getting information or getting pictures from these locations because most of them are marshy. You know, you need a boat to be out on them. It's not that you can just walk down to the beach. But it is the week that it hit. And I think people are, in the last day or two, feeling a little bit more positive that something's being done. I mean, they're very, very frustrated. But, you know, the understanding now is the Coast Guard is in charge of the response down here, not BP. And many of the parish presidents have kind of gone out of their way to say, we're going to start doing things regardless of, you know, if we have the okay from the federal government or the Coast Guard or BP. You know, we have to start protecting our marshes. And I will be out tomorrow in St. Bernard Parish, doing some work helping them clean and protect the marsh, and then responding if there are any animals that we find in distress, we will be picking them up and transporting them to private veterinarians if need be.
I'm glad to hear that you'll be out there and that others will be out there as well. And I know that you continue to report on what you calculate is the number of animals who are killed. I'm assuming that you continue to find that the numbers that are being publicized are radically wrong.
Yes, without a doubt. And I think that, again, not to repeat myself, we're starting to get a little bit more information this week, and we're learning that there has been more oil than was originally announced, and that, you know, under the water, the places that we can't see, there is an incredible amount of devastation. Our number, the number PATH has been using with that, you know, that same formula, is over 25,000 at this point. And again, I think it's very conservative. I have heard on the news tonight they're saying 18 to 28 million gallons of oil have gone in the past 37 days. Mm. So that's under 1,000 animals per million gallons of oil. So it's frustrating to watch this number grow and to really know that these are vulnerable creatures. They're suffering. They're out there. And 99 times out of 100, no one responds. No one has ever seen them. You know, they spend, whether it be an hour, a day, or weeks suffering and then kind of sink to the bottom.
It's really not even just the oil that's gone in, is it? I've been reading so much about the coagulants that they've put in to try to contain the oil are actually extremely toxic.
Oh, that is a very, very good point. And we don't know what's going to happen with the dispersants. They really hadn't been tested, and we have never dumped this many chemicals in a body of water before that. So, for lack of a better answer, yes, we don't know what this does to wildlife and to their habitats and to people, but it's probably nothing good.
Thank you so much, Kelly, for joining us. Let us know if there's anything you need from us or from anyone else who might be listening.
Of course. Thank you both so much.
Obviously, it's hard to hear such despair, especially when Kelly is the one who's down there and he's experiencing it firsthand and seeing how slowly things are moving. But I really am hopeful that things are moving in the right direction. The mainstream media is starting to notice, with the efforts of people like Kelly and other groups who are down there. We will do the best we can to help the flora and fauna who are being affected by this tragedy. You can stay on top of Kelly's efforts on his website, ppath.org. And now, let's get into some news now, shall we? So there was an investigation this week, yet another one by the lovely group Mercy for Animals.
Yeah, this one, I am told, has incredibly hideous footage, and I have to admit, and actually one of the things I wanted to talk about was how impossible it is to watch this stuff. I don't know whether I should feel obligated to, or whether I'm off the hook because I'm vegan. I really don't know how to react to this.
Well, I tend to think that you don't have to watch it, but that every now and again we should watch footage just to sort of remind ourselves. But I don't think we need to feel obligated to watch every single thing that comes out. I actually started watching it kind of by accident. I just went to the Mercy for Animals website, and I had to stop, and I pretty much was traumatized just from that. But I do think it's important that absolutely everybody knows about it, and that certainly people who are not yet vegan watch it and know about it as well.
Yeah, I actually have heard of two separate people who vomited from watching this. This is apparently some of the worst stuff. Which, you know, it's an irony of animal protection work that what happens to animals, especially farm, well, not just farm animals, research animals as well, and even puppies sometimes, animals in puppy mills. But we're focusing on farm animals, and sometimes what happens to them is so bad, it's so hideous, that people can't even stand to know about it.
Well, what kind of investigation was this?
It was dairy.
Yeah, it was a dairy farm. It was a family-owned farm. Apparently, it was not exactly just a dairy farm, because they also were dealing in cows. They were buying and selling. But they had touted their
their wholesomeness and their family farminess quite a bit. Apparently the owner is one of the people caught on tape, though not the worst of it. And of course the industry is now trying to pass it off as you know, an aberrational act. And it's almost, though I certainly want the people to be prosecuted, it's almost disturbing to see that the response in the press is that the one guy who just was doing the most hideous acts, I mean, and we're talking really hideous cruelty, stabbing animals with pitchforks, among other things. He was arrested, now he's being charged with cruelty. And that's how they'll deal with it, as if it was the act of one sadist. And the fact is that sadism is throughout this industry, and the only way it's policed is for ballot initiatives to curb some of the worst abuses of the regular confinement, and for undercover investigators to go in, risk their safety, and obviously they're dealing with some very evil people, get this film, give it to prosecutors, and then the prosecutors say, oh yeah, that was against the law, we'll prosecute this. Well, that is not an enforcement system. Something, to state a cliche, has to be done.
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable stuff, and totally urgent that all of us pass this on. That, you know, at first we weren't even going to put it on our blog because we don't tend to post news items on our blog. We just talk about them in the podcast, and we use the blog as opportunities for activists to get further involved. But when something like this happens, it's completely necessary that everybody from all walks of life and every different corner of our movement and not our movement comes together and sheds light on it. So put it on your Facebook page, put it on your Twitter page, email it to people. I don't care how you get it out there, but it's
totally... Talk about it.
Talk about it.
There's plenty of people who will never see this, will never see it on the news. It actually hasn't hit any big news yet. Of course, Jane Velez Mitchell covered it because she's our hero, but...
You know, there's always room for bigger.
But aside from... I know plenty of people who even when that huge investigation broke the news and got a lot of press last year in California, plenty of people who never heard of that because they don't really watch the news or they just don't pay attention to that story. So talk about it. Just talk about it all the time. I know, at the risk of annoying everybody, you know, but sometimes you just got to bite the bullet and drive people crazy.
In other news, puppy mills are in the news.
Yeah, two big items, the MFA investigation and the puppy mill report. And even though these both seem like bad news because they're all about bad things happening, they're actually good news because they mean these bad things happen all the time, and they mean there's some attention's being paid to them. The puppy mill news, amazingly, came out of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Wow.
Yeah, every once in a while, the Department of Agriculture's Office of Inspector General, which is kind of the police department for the whole Department of Agriculture, does a report. I mean, they do reports on all the different, many, many different segments of the USDA, and every once in a while they do one on animal care, which is the segment of USDA entrusted with enforcing the Animal Welfare Act. And every single time they do one, it's absolutely scathing, it's extremely critical, it says the agency is not doing its job. I don't know why this never gets fixed. It's pretty... alarming, but there is no. This is the perfect source of information. This is the gold standard. You are cite when you can cite the USDA itself talking about how poorly enforced the Animal Welfare Act is. You are able to make an incredibly convincing case. And this time they focused on enforcement against puppy mills, and they pretty much said that the department was not enforcing the Animal Welfare Act's provisions regulating puppy mills, that horrible abuses were going on, and the USDA was taking its usual route of educating violators rather than punishing them. Mm-hmm. This is the standard process. They think that the USDA thinks it's job is to keep agricultural interests, in which they would include puppy mills, in business. And if they're not doing a good job, well, it's to help them do a better job, but not to put them out of business. Well, hoo-ha on that. Put them out of business. Anyway, the report was very vicious, very critical. Vilsack immediately responded, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, which is a great sign. He was lucky enough to not be in office when this investigation was performed, so he could sort of disavow any responsibility for it. And he promised greater enforcement. Also, I think some congressmen and senators are introducing an act that would extend the
protections, if you want to call them protections after this report of the Animal Welfare Act, to puppy mills that sell directly to the public. Because of the USDA's ridiculous interpretation of the term retail pet store, they don't include under their enforcement any breeder that sells directly to the public, even though they're exactly doing the exactly same thing that all the other breeders do. So some good could come of this. I really think some good could come of this. This is a pretty high level criticism of the puppy mill industry.
Some distressing news earlier this week from Dawn Watch.
Yeah, well, distressing news from the Gulf. There's pretty much nothing but distressing news from the Gulf. Actually, the oil is starting to hit the beach, which could be the new expression, replacing the shit is hitting the fan, because things are really bad down there, and it's starting to become more evident, and the mainstream press is starting to cover it. There was a nice article today in the Washington Post about the impact on wildlife. But the really tragic news from Karen Dawn, which I hadn't realized before, is that according to leading scientists in the area, you really can't do anything to help these animals. Even the birds who are captured, and it's very hard to capture them, but even if they are captured, even if they're cleaned, even if they're given treatment for the oil they've ingested, they don't survive. It makes people feel better, but it doesn't really do a whole lot more for the birds. They fly off, and then they die within days. Really just adding more horror to an already horrible situation.
I don't really understand why this is just now coming out. I mean, I'm confused, to be honest. I'm also confused by the fact that those commercials for years for Dawn soap, is Dawn soap trying to get oil off of birds? Was that a scam?
Oh, I have no idea. I don't know enough about it. And I'm not sure I would say it is coming out. Karen Dawn is talking about it. But apparently the thing that got her to talk about it was that on Anderson Cooper, who's great on animal issues and will try to do the best job, he had, of all people, Jack Hanna on to talk about this issue, who was touting the benefits of cleaning these birds and talking about how vigorously SeaWorld would be helping in this effort. So I guess the reason it hasn't come out is that everything is pretty much a scam.
Well, that's cheery. Everything's a scam. Yeah, I want to read more about that and hear what's going on. It's just sometimes things are so depressing, you know. I guess it's at those times when we really have to channel activism and do everything we possibly can to make things just a little bit better.
Yeah, you got to tap into that anger and make something happen.
And that was our news. So we did another Facebook survey.
Yeah, it was a kind of interesting one.
This is what we asked. What do you think is the biggest misconception about veganism, and how do you respond when that misconception comes up? We got really a lot of responses, and a lot of them were really good. I love these Facebook surveys.
Yeah, they were kind of all over the lot, about some about the diet, some about animals, some about actually your personal beliefs.
So let's read what a few that stuck out for us, but as with all of our surveys, they were really all great and worth reading. So somebody named Laura Donna Loy said that veganism is only about food. I explain that it's a way of life, a complete process of respecting nature and questioning our place in the world as humans.
Yeah, I think that that's probably my favorite of the whole bunch. That, and it perhaps it's a bad word because it just does sound like a diet. And it's so much more than that. It's so fundamental. It so changes your whole relationship with the world. If you're really talking about a seriously vegan attitude towards the world and understanding our place in it and understanding your relationship to the other life on this planet, that to me, that's what veganism is. There's virtually nobody who understands that who isn't vegan.
Somebody named Jennifer Lynn McGinney said that a misconception that she hears often is that it's expensive, and she tells them her grocery bill. It can be expensive, just like anything else, but it certainly doesn't have to be.
No, it certainly doesn't have to be at all. And really, sadly,
it should be so much less expensive than it is because there are no subsidies from the government for the growing of fruits and vegetables. All the subsidies go to the feed crops for that are fed to animals, the corn, the soybean.
Yeah, and that's not to say that there's not issues. I think that there are a lot of issues. I'm not really prepared to get into this subject right now, but I just wanted to give validity to the fact that it is true that a lot of more privileged people have these foods more readily available to them, and there is a such thing as dietary racism.
Yeah, that's a whole totally other discussion. Which we don't really have time to give.
I just wanted to bring up the fact that I realize that that's not a, you know, cut or dry situation. So another one, Ariana Humer. She says, them. It's so hard being vegan. I don't know what to cook. Them. I just can't give up cheese. Me. Shut up, you whiny, weak-willed, self-indulgent moron.
Yeah, gotta love that one.
Danielle Jo Bays. I have two, Danielle says. First, that I can't eat something. That just irritates me. Simply pointing out that it is a choice I am making, a philosophical decision and not a medical issue. It makes veganism seem negative and vegans martyrs.
Yeah, that's actually one of my pet peeves. I really hate it when somebody will say, usually it's not even they're telling me. They're speaking about me in the third person. Oh no, Marianne can't eat that. And maybe they're trying to be thoughtful, I don't know, but it just drives me crazy. And actually, my colleague at work has learned, he says it all the time, oh yeah, Marianne can eat that. And I give him one look, and then he quickly corrects himself. She chooses not to eat it. Yeah, which is exactly the point. I can eat anything I want. I choose to eat a certain number of things, and I choose not to eat others because of a whole variety of reasons.
Yeah, so Danielle continues. She says, second, that being vegan is needless because animals aren't treated that badly. The person will state a belief that animals should be raised and slaughtered humanely and reference some, quote, humane farm that they heard about or a producer that they met at a farmer's market once. When asked if that's where they get their dead animal flesh, the answer is always no. Sometimes the person will then grasp that their actions aren't in sync with their stated beliefs. I also like to add that it doesn't matter how well the animals were treated, as we shouldn't consider them food in the first place. That is a really good point. Like a lot of people who, you know, say, know nothing about what quote unquote humane means, but say that they believe in humane meat, and then they'll talk about some farm somewhere. And it's like, okay, even if they do believe in that BS, which they probably don't even know the fact that it's, that it has no regulations or very lax regulations, they don't get their food there in the first place.
Yeah, that's actually my, I have a lot of peeves with the whole humane meat thing, but that's my pet peeve, that people don't even follow what they claim to be their own beliefs.
And then, of course, a lot of the people on the Facebook page did talk about the protein, because obviously that's a big one. And I like the way this person wrote her response, Marika Collins. She said, one would be that we don't get enough protein or certain minerals like iron, calcium, B12, etc. I did the research on nutrition and read books like the China Study and others, and armed with solid information, I am able to respond with the facts. For example, that all plants contain protein and a varied plant-based diet provide more than enough protein. Non-vegans overconsume protein, which is detrimental to their health. There are 24 grams of protein in a 4-ounce serving of seitan, 20 grams in a 1/2 cup of firm tofu, 18 grams in a cup of lentils. According to Dr. Campbell's China Study, the most extensive and complete study of nutrition and disease ever conducted, animal protein is proven to promote cancer and other degenerative diseases, whereas plant protein does not. With regard to refuting the mineral deficiency claims, the best sources of calcium and other critical minerals are plants, especially green leafy vegetables like spinach, kale, chard, etc. Then I'll go on to tell them that milk actually leaches calcium from your bones and promotes osteoporosis, based on a study funded by the dairy industry themselves, found that out via John McDougall. B12 is easily gotten from nutritional yeast, for example, and fortified non-dairy milks and cereals. And how about this for a nutritional tidbit or two? There is more iron in dark chocolate than in beef.
Well, what could I possibly add to that?
She really did her homework, and it's true. Everything she says is true. Somebody else, Pam J. Papa, said, the assumption that everyone eats meat, dairy, and eggs, and that those who don't eat these are missing out on something. We eschew the few animal-based dishes for the cornucopia of vegan goodies.
Yeah, of course, that's a very common misconception, that there's nothing to eat.
Linnea Lestadius said that a misconception that she finds quite frequently is that I feel like I'm sacrificing or something, or I'm missing out, when the truth is it's not a sacrifice when you know what the reality of these things are. I don't even consider dairy or meat to be a food anymore, so how could I feel like I'm missing out on it? I feel the same way. I can't, like, it just doesn't register as food to me. Amanda Riley said that I secretly long for meat and that it would be okay if I eat one piece. I won't tell anyone, so I just pretty much tell them straight up I only missed meat for the first few months I was vegetarian. Now the smell nauseates me. Please don't shove animal products in my face, because veganism is one of the most important things in my life, and your behavior offends me. And she says, people are usually rendered speechless by stuff like that. Honor Jeffrey Faboon says, when I explain that I don't use eggs or dairy, people often assume that I don't bake or can't have desserts. I usually respond by whipping up a plate of cupcakes. My family and friends are spoiled on yummy, cruelty-free baked goods.
I do remember in the earlier days of veganism, it really was hard to get vegan desserts, and it was a lot easier to avoid them. Now I find them very tempting all the time.
Yeah, and now they're all around us, too. Which, literally in New York City, there you could get which is, a good problem to have. And then lastly, but not least, Michelle Newton said that cows need to be milked or they will explode. And so dairy farmers are actually doing them a favor. I explained that cows are like humans. They actually produce the milk after pregnancy for the purpose of nourishing their offspring. Then I explained the veal industry and how the calves used in it were actually considered to be a waste product of the dairy industry until factory farmers decided to market these sickly calves as a delicacy. It's another one, too. I like to bring up the veal connection whenever possible, because there's so many people who don't eat veal because it's un-PC or whatever, and yet they're sitting there guzzling their milk.
To tell the truth, I was well advanced into my adulthood and veganism before I understood that cows were mammals and functioned just like all its other mammals and had to have babies in order to provide milk. It came as a shock to me at some point, and it's just amazing how much misinformation we are fed about animals. I mean, virtually everyone misunderstands those facts about cows.
It's funny, too, because then when you realize it or you're taught that, it's like, oh, yeah, it's like, you've just figured that out. How could we not have known? Anyway, so that was a really interesting little survey doodad, and I do these surveys on my own Facebook page, Jasmine Singer, no E on Jasmine, not on our hen houses, only because I find that more conversation ensues from my Facebook page than from our hen houses, but I don't know, maybe I should switch that over. Regardless, that was our podcast for today. We're so happy that you've joined us, and thank you so much to our guests, Kelly Overton once again, and Brad Goldberg, of course. And thank you to you for listening. Please visit our website at ourhenhouse.org. Email us at info@ourhenhouse.org. Find us on Facebook. And go vegan. Bye.
Bye.